Welcome to the Point Forward podcast with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's J.R. Radcliffe and Jim Ozarski, an over-caffeinated Milwaukee Bucks conversation.
The Point Forward podcast, Milwaukee Bucks chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and on the other line, I've got a couple luminaries from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That's Bucks reporters Jim Ozarski and Lori Nickel. It was a bad start to the playoffs for the Milwaukee Bucks on two very important fronts. One, they lost Game 1 to the Miami Heat on Sunday night. So they're down in the series, no games to one, with the next game coming up Wednesday at Pfizer Forum. But the more important issue, number two, Giannis Antetokounmpo, he leaves the game first in the first quarter after taking a hard fall on his backside. He did try coming back, checked back onto the floor briefly, but ultimately had to leave the game and did not play after the second quarter with a back contusion. X-rays supposedly clean is the terminology, which I guess means it's not a fracture, but definitely some question marks about Giannis's availability, at least in the near term going forward. So obviously some reason for concern in Bucks land. So Jim and Lori, they were there. They saw the whole thing. And Lori, I'm actually going to start with you because I know you were there afterwards. You wrote about Giannis's injury. I'm sure you got a little bit of a temperature, what the players were thinking, the coaches, what they were thinking and saying, if this is, you know, if they're upbeat, if they think this is still something that they can handle, at least in the short term, or if there is a little bit of discomfort, certainly with what's going on. So give me just the lay of the land of what you were experiencing after that game on Sunday night.
The Bucks all were pretty, not evasive, but they were just dealing with what they knew at the moment. And they certainly didn't reveal anything that we don't already know. We don't know the future prognosis for Giannis. They reflected more on the fact that they just didn't play well without him, even though there's plenty of experience this year to show that they can play well without him. They had an 11-6 record that Jim pointed out, playing without Giannis when he was resting with knee issues or wrist issues during the season. So the fact that the Bucks played so poorly without him was something that they were disappointed in. But in terms of reading the room, I don't know that like Budenholzer looked super concerned, but that's really hard to read or, you know, overanalyze because that loss was so bad. So it just wasn't a great vibe overall for the whole day. So, you know, but like Drew Holiday said, I hate to see him hurt. It's just not a good thing. And, you know, so I have more questions than answers right now about what's going to happen in the coming days.
Jim, I think everyone understands the Bucks are not going to win a championship without Giannis Antetokounmpo, but they could win this series against the 8th-seeded Miami Heat. But like I said, like my concern going into this is they still have some dudes, and it's just these peripheral players who have not played well over the course of the year. Now, they stepped up big time in this game, and I think you could argue it's somewhat unsustainable, but it's also, you know, a game one loss is a game one loss. What is your sense? Like, let's say Giannis misses a couple games, even if, you know, I don't know if we're quite to the point where we have to think about the long term issues here that, you know, that he could be gone for multiple series in the playoffs. I don't think anybody is suggesting that just yet. But let's say he misses a few games. How worried would you be after watching Milwaukee simply just be unable to get over the hump there in game one, that this team without Giannis maybe is going to struggle to even win this series against the Miami Heat? What would be the concern level be?
Well, I mean, to say struggle, I mean, is that six games? you would have thought.
Well, losing the series is top of mind for me personally. But yeah.
Look, I mean, let's not forget the Heat lost Tyler Hero altogether. And that's a big deal for them. You know, whether Giannis plays or not, the Heat, yeah, they scored 130 points. They shot 60%. The math says that that's not a sustainable number. You know, I think Jimmy and Bam Adebayo can combine for 50 points, 48 points. I think that's, you know, look, those are two all NBA quality players, but they only went essentially eight deep, you know, and Duncan Robinson played 6 minutes. You know, how does that affect Eric Spoelstra? Does that mean Caleb Martin must start now, you know, or Kyle Lowry has to start now? Like, there's a reason those guys were on the bench, right? Because Tyler's a really good player. He's arguably their most dynamic offensive player in terms of just the ability to explode for points. you know, Jimmy scored 35 points on 27 shots. So to your question, JR, sure, if Giannis is out, and I don't believe that's going to be the case, but if he's out or he's limited to a degree where he's not himself, okay, yeah, look, I'm going to give the Heat credit. They won game one on the road, so does that mean they can win a game at home? Sure. So does this turn into a six-game series as opposed to four or five? I guess unless something were to change between the recording of this podcast and in the next few days where Giannis is out. But I think this team is still too prideful and honestly too deep. I think the Heat just don't have enough to win four games as we sit here knowing what we know.
Yeah, to your point, like you said, Duncan Robinson, 6 minutes. That's the ninth guy that they rotated in. Otherwise, it's eight guys, and that includes Tyler Hero, who broke his wrist and is going to be out for, I believe, 4 to 6 weeks is the prognostication on him. So he's done for this series at the very least. And guard play was always going to be a concern for them. You know, Gabe Vincent as your point guard, he had a great game. I mean, he made 4 or 5 deep. He scored 15 points, had 6 assists. Like, that's a great, great game for him, much better than he had been during the regular season. And I don't know if you can rely on that. Kevin Love scoring 18 points off the bench, that's incredible. That's as good as he did at any point during the regular season. I think in 22 games, he had like 5 double figures performances, period, and one that got as high as 18 points. Well, then he hits 4 of 7 3-pointers, has 8 rebounds, 18 points off the bench. These are things, Caleb Martin as well, these are things that you probably don't imagine will continue, but certainly now we know that they can happen, at least in the short term. I don't know if 15 of 25 3-point shooting as a team can actually happen for the Miami Heat again. I don't know if they're actually physically capable of doing that twice, but we know that they can do it once, so that at least has to put that thought in the back of your mind. Laurie, just overall, do you attribute this game? Do you look at this game and say crazy things happen that cannot be repeated, i.e., Giannis getting hurt and going out, the Bucks just not being able to stack up defensive stops, the Heat shooting far better than they did during the regular season? Do you throw this game out and say that's just it's just a lot of outliers falling at the same time?
No, I don't. I have changed. You know, you warned us like last podcast that the Heat would be like a threat or whatever it was. And I was like, they don't have enough. And I've changed my tune totally because, you know, Eric Spoelstra, the coach, said they came into that game with a Navy SEAL mentality. And Jimmy Butler said they needed to play a damn near perfect game, which they think they're capable of doing multiple times. And Bam Adebayo said, you know, the uneven waters that they played in all regular season long have prepared them for the playoffs. So I have a newfound respect for this Miami team. We Bucks fans are very familiar with this Miami Heat team, even though it's changed somewhat. The core guys are the same, and they just don't, you know, what they fell short of during the regular season. I mean, in one game during the Bucks, during the regular season in February, they played the Bucks and they only shot 25% from 3-point range. They have been known to struggle offensively. So all season long. So why did they, you know, play so well on the road in Milwaukee? And the thing that I found was interesting, I had to go back and double check to make sure I heard it right. You know, Mike Budenholzer said after the game on Sunday night, he thinks significantly that the Bucks contested enough of the Miami Heat 3-point attempts. And I thought, really? Because where we sit up in the media box, I didn't see that. I thought, boy, some of these shots are too easy, too open. So I think there's so many red flags from this game for the Bucks, whether it lasts just one game or whatever it is. I thought there were enough red flags raised in this kind of matchup, given all the time that the Bucks had to take time to take care of their body, to be prepared for Miami. And, you know, I don't use the excuse that the Bucks were the last team to find out who their opponent was. They didn't find out until late Friday night. They knew the Heat well enough to be prepared. So no, I don't call this a fluky game. I think there's enough to be at least a little bit concerned about, whether it's a red flag for future series in the playoffs or even just this series.
Jim, it feels to me, or seems to me, that the biggest problem the Bucks had when Giannis went out was on the defensive end, that they sort of shifted what they were doing. I think they went zone a couple times, and they had Brook Lopez kind of patrolling the paint to just challenge whoever dare come in there. It was effective at times, actually, but that sort of, you know, Brook versus everyone gave Miami, I think, some opportunities. Bam Adebayo especially had some sort of mid-range to, like, you know, low to mid-range shots that he was able to make. And the Heat just found a rhythm. They were able to be really consistent there. I don't know if that's something they would go to again. You know, losing Giannis midstream, I think it's probably, if I had to guess, a little more complicated to adjust defensively. And that if you knew going into the game you didn't have him, you could maybe change the shape of what you're doing defensively. I'm a little out of my league if I try to imagine what that looks like. So do you see that as kind of the right, you know, the right way to look at where they missed Giannis? Or do you feel like, you know, if they went into this again, they'd probably do similar things defensively and Miami might be able to get cooking again?
You know, look, to me, zones in the NBA are usually I don't want to call them a last ditch because they are more prevalent now. But I feel like they're usually meant to try to disrupt a team that's already in a rhythm to a degree. So I don't know how much we'll see of that, regardless of Giannis's status. Look, Bam Adebayo is a unique big in the sense that he's 6'9", you know, and Brook being Brook, he's very good, but that's still there is a quickness mismatch there. You know, Bam is also, you know, 10 years younger than Brook. So it makes sense that Brook defends him, but, you know, to ask him to sort of defend him one-on-one is tough. And Bam lives in the mid-range. You know, I think if you were to tell the Bucks that Jimmy Butler is going to shoot 8 free throws and Bam Adebayo is going to shoot 3, that they did a good job in contesting without fouling, Bam just happened to go 10 for 18. You know, Jimmy shot 15 to 27. You know, these other guys like Tyler Hero, Gabe Vincent, Caleb Mark just didn't miss. Kevin Love didn't miss. You're right. Like defensively, you know, Wesley Matthews was really perturbed by the Heat shooting 60%. To Laurie's point, like, did they contest those threes as closely as the head coach seemed to think in the immediate aftermath? I don't know. If Giannis is out, and look, whether he plays or not, he's clearly going to be limited to a degree. So I could see Drew Holiday on Jimmy Butler again, and knowing Drew, he's going to take that personally going forward. So I think you just do what you do. I understand series are about adjustments. I think an adjustment the Bucks may make is being a little more mindful of someone getting out in transition, and helping prevent some of those easy buckets that the Heat clearly tried to take advantage of. Maybe that's something, but Grayson Allen noted, he's like, look, we're a good offensive rebounding team. It's a good strategy to have against us. You know, clearly the Heat had an emphasis there. So perhaps that's part of the cat and mouse, JR, but I just don't think if you're the Bucks, you just drastically change things, because look, Brook Lopez might win defensive player of the year by the time you're listening to this late Monday night or Tuesday. Like, I think you just kind of do what you do, and just, you know, hope but expect that it's executed better.
Laurie, you had something you wanted to add.
I just wanted to ask you guys your opinion or your thoughts on this. Miami had 62 points in the paint, and I wondered how much that affected Milwaukee's ability to defend anything. And I wondered, you know, Jim, in your experience, isn't that a pretty high number, 62 in the paint? And I just, if you're trying to, I mean, again, sitting way up in the press box, not having TV, our audience should know you're seeing more on television than we are seeing live in person at Pfizer Forum. But even I could see sitting all the way up there that the Heat would drive, score inside, and by the time the Bucks defense was there, they were already under the basket. It was too late to defend anything. And after another Heat basket, guys would be looking at each other like with a questioning look, like, where were you? Where were you? And I haven't seen that all year long. So how much do you think that point in the paint thing just sort of threw everything off kilter for the Bucks?
Yeah, I think for sure. You know, the Bucks. Look, the Bucks were middle. This might surprise people. The Bucks were sort of a middle of the pack team in defending points in the paint. You would think that's wouldn't be true. I mean, they were 13th in the league, 49, well, tied for 12th, allowing a shade under 50 points per game in the paint. So 62 is clearly, you know, no, you know, even San Antonio didn't allow that on like as a season average. So that's really high. I think some of that too, though, it's not like they were dunking on everyone. I think that's where the Bucks will look at this, where they just hit. So they just got into that. Maybe the too short mid range. Is that a phrase? Like, you know, like they weren't 18 footers. You know, they were 12 footers. Right. They were more high percentage mid range. And clearly, because they made them all, like they're 60%. Like, so yeah, Laurie, I think when that happens, there's a natural inclination to help, to leave your person. And yeah, they look, the Heat only took 25 threes, the Bucks took 45. You know, the Heat made 15, the Bucks made 11. Like, that's, you know, and I know fans, and I do get tired of this too, about the whole like, is it a make or miss league? But like, if the Bucks make what, 10 more threes? It's a different game, like literally. So I don't know, Laurie, you're right. Like the Bucks maybe just say, hey, be more disciplined with your 3-point defense. And if they're going to take mid range, like we'll live with that. Like that's the lower percentage shot. But yeah, I think in this game, particularly Laurie, yeah, their effectiveness in the painted area, you know, not dunking all over everyone. I think did have an effect on the perimeter defense.
Under Mike Budenholzer, the Bucks are now 4-8. If I have my math right, I think 4-8 in game ones, which is staggering to me.
Yeah.
And if you look at that, of those four wins, first of all, they lost two of those series. They also won one of those game ones on a buzzer beater, Chris Middleton against the Heat, obviously in 2021 during the championship run at the buzzer in overtime. So even that one is barely a win. Yet they've also gone on to win three of those series in which they lost game one by 4-1 counts. But this happens. I mean, they lost to Orlando. That was in the bubble. But they lost at home against the Boston Celtics back in 2019. They lost, of course, last year to the Chicago Bulls. Like, these are not teams that should be beating them at home. And yet they have run into this time and time again. They've only lost one series in which they've lost game one. And that was in the bubble. So this is not a new place for them. But I guess at some point you have to wonder, like, does it need to be a place at all? Like, what is going on? How is it that the Bucks seem to be in this place where they continually, with the talent that they have, can't get out of the gate quickly? I mean, you can argue the rest versus Russ thing, you know, the fact that it's been really almost two full weeks since they played a meaningful basketball game, and I get why that's the case. But every time somebody makes that argument, I'm also saying to myself, if you're the best team in the league, you need the rest. The rest is the only thing that matters because you've got stars, you're the best team in the league, and you want everybody to be healthier. So there's no scenario where you choose anything other than as much time off as possible. I don't know if that's what we chalk this up to, or if it's just some sort of weird, like, pervasive mentality thing, or if it's just dumb luck. I don't know. So Laurie, what do you think about that? Is that this trend that's strangely developed under a very successful Mike Budenholzer regime? Is it something that we can look at this point, or is it just, I don't know, just random noise still?
Yeah, I didn't even know that it was that bad. And I can't make heads or tails of that either. The Bucks had to rest. They're going to play another two. You have to assume that they're going to play 2 months to win a championship. And so you know, they have, again, this huge coaching staff. So there's no way that they weren't prepared. You know, Chris Middleton is a game film junkie. That guy is watching film all the time. There's no way that they didn't know. And they, you know, and this is also not a team of slackers or selfish people. They have a singular goal in mind. So I don't know. I don't ever want to talk about officiating but I thought that game just started weird and felt weird. Game one didn't resemble anything that I saw during the regular season, both the way it was called and the way it was played, and things looked kind of awkward. And now, you know, so I lean more towards that. Like, there's such a transformation between regular season ball and playoff ball, and the athleticism that's in the NBA right now seems to have exceeded the rules of the game that are meant to protect the players. If you look at Ja Morant's play and how he got injured, the guy was like off the ground 12 feet. I swear to God, like he just, and how do you protect a player who's that athletic, who can go that high and fall that hard? And Giannis will have some of those same concerns too. He's such a strong player. So to me, it was more like, how do the officials get control of this early on without taking over the game? Because, and again, this is just my opinion, and I don't pretend to be the expert. I would love to hear what you guys think, but I just thought, boy, this is such a stark contrast to the offensively driven, offensively favored league all regular season long that then switches and becomes a bloodbath in the playoffs, where bodies are flying and falling down every other possession to a point where it could be a risky injury situation.
Jim, do you have any thoughts on this? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, I believe Sports Illustrated and the New York Times, Lori, have already opined on this. Ja Morant was injured for Memphis on a similar scenario. His wrist and hand bending awkwardly. His x-rays were negative, but he, after his game, he didn't know if he'd be able to play game two. I mean, we've seen these charges and sliding in. I think it, you know, it brings it to a greater light. Like, I don't think the NBA wants Giannis and Ja not participating in these playoffs because they went in the air and these legal moves were made by defenders, you know, or at least they attempted to be legal, you know, and that, you know, we'll see. We'll see. If this were the NFL, like, they would change the, right? Like, if these were quarterbacks, the rule would be changed, like, right now.
I
right?
agree with you completely.
You know, the NBA doesn't really operate that way, but, and that could be another conversation. But, like, to Lori's point, officiating is a tough road to go down. I mean, Giannis in particular, we wrote about this over the All-Star break. Like, he is, retired officials have said, he is the most difficult player in the league to officiate because of what he does, how he does it, how good he is at not charging for as many charges as he's called for. It's tough. Like, it's a tough thing. And, you know, I think he's lived with it his whole career. The Bucks have lived with it. You know, I think the fact that, but to the broader point, I think the fact that Mike Budenholzer used a challenge in the first quarter on a Jrue Holiday offensive foul said all you needed to know about how this thing started. And maybe there's an overcorrection. We've seen that in NBA games. So I guess we'll just have to see going forward what, you know, how this plays out in the way it's called.
Yeah, I understand.
What do you guys think of the game one thing? What do you think about, like, why the Bucks have such terrible record at game one?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's how we started this part. I got caught on the officiating. It is weird. Laura, you know this. You've covered so many Packers teams that had byes. Like, it tends to be a question. Like why that is. It's clearly a trend. So you, and a wide berth of opponents and talent. So I don't know. Everything the players said, the coach said, other coaches said, was that this last week of practice was really good for the Bucks. They didn't turn the ball over a ton. You know, typically in these games, like, Jrue Holiday doesn't shoot well, and Giannis and Drew and Chris combined for like 13 turnovers by themselves. I mean, we've seen that before coming out of All-Star breaks or games where if these guys have missed a week, that didn't really happen. So I don't know. I don't know. It's a trend. I think if we were to ask Bud, he would say, well, if I knew the answer, we wouldn't do it. So I don't know. It is a very weird, very weird thing, but they also tend to rebound. You know, yeah, they went down 0-2 a couple times in the championship run, but for the most part, you know, they're not really, you know, chasing too poorly after dropping a game one.
Of course, both of those occasions were on the road. They went down 2-0. So they I would argue going down 2-0 at home is a pretty significant setback, although this team could surely win in Miami. Again, we are talking about the eighth seed, at most charitably the seventh seed in the Eastern Conference. So the Bucks should have the edge there. Going back to the defense thing and the charge drawing, I there's a fine line in the NFL, I think, kind of has to grapple with this quite a bit. You know, are you altering the very nature of your sport because you've decided that the nature of the entertainment value is more valuable? And also the fact that we're talking about the greatest athletes in the world, you know, running into each other. Maybe you do need to have different rules for charges and blocks, because a collision between Giannis and Kevin Love is going to result in someone, you know, somebody dying. It's just a crazy, you know, the level play is just so crazy and so intense. So that is something to consider. I think the NBA will probably take a look at it. But, you know, this is tale as old as time, drawing charges and block, you know, like, that's defense. Part of defense is simply getting in the way. And I know that, you know, we can argue about that, I guess, but part of defense is just kind of being an obstacle. So sometimes these things unfortunately happen. And obviously it is a big loss to the NBA at large, but more specifically the Milwaukee Bucks. I don't know if there's anything else from this game specifically, other than just to kind of put a bow on it. Miami cannot do this again. Like, this is just wild what they were able to do. They truly played at the peak of their powers, especially considering they didn't have Tyler Hero for most of that game. I do think Tyler Hero is a massive loss for them, and I just can't imagine that you're going to see all of, you know, Max Strus and Gabe Vincent and Kevin Love playing this well. And you know, there were times I thought the Bucks were still going to win that game. They got back within 1 point early in the second half, and I thought, here we go. The Bucks are they've gotten their groove, and credit to Miami, they found that punch, that extra punch. But I just cannot envision that happening three more times. Maybe it happens one more time, but I still feel like if you're a Bucks fan, you should be very confident and just look to last year. And, you know, when they played Orlando in the bubble, like, they figured it out against teams that they should beat. And even though Miami's got some names, this is definitely a team they should beat. So I think guys, they should be pretty comfortable. Just overall, right? Like Lori, you still feel good about this deep down, right?
Well, sure. I mean, they can beat Miami. To me, the concern is long-term, big picture, how they do in future series and stuff like that. To me, this is more like, you know, wow, this is a little bit concerning for a championship run. One of the things that's always bothered me about this Bucks team is their three-point production themselves and how they would get past the best in the East with that. And also, you know, I'm watching Brooke Lopez. I didn't think he looked his normal self yesterday. And of course he's entitled to have a game my concern isn't that they won't get past the Heat. My concern is, what does this say about their championship run? That's all.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Brooke Lopez, because as we record this on Monday night, we will learn Monday evening, whether or not Brooke Lopez has won the Defensive Player of the Year award. He's one of three finalists, which we've talked about this in the past, but that finalist terminology is a little misleading. The votes are all in and have been counted. These are the top three finishers, and they just want you to think that they're to add to the drama, a little spice, but nobody is voting anew on these three names. It's already been decided. So we will find out if he's at the top of the heap there, if he takes second or third. Jim, I wanted to talk to you about that, but actually, before we get there, there's one more thing I want to touch on, and that is your conversation with Mark Lazary, now the former owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. He officially sold his stake to the Haslams. That is a deal that has gone through. So I guess Jimmy Haslam in his first kind of a nice spot. You just suddenly you're in the middle of the playoffs. You don't have to deal with the regular season as an owner. That would be great. I think that would be everyone's best case scenario. But you talked to Mark Lazary and kind of some of his rationale for making the move, and you know what, you know, looking back on his tenure a little bit, you wrote about that at jsonline.com, but what were your takeaways? What things really jumped out at you in your conversation with Mark Lazary?
Yeah, so it is official, something we've been talking about here for weeks. So what Mark admitted, he was very reserved in this conversation, and just he acknowledged it was bittersweet after 9 years, almost to the date that he and Wes Edens were announced as the new owners of the Bucks, buying it from former Senator Herb Kohl. So I think there was a, I mean, he made the deal. I don't think, you know, he regrets that, but he did acknowledge, like, well, I guess we'll see in 5 years if this was really the right move. But I think he meant more in terms of a financial stake. I think he wasn't sure where franchise valuations would go, where they might continue to go. They currently, you know, are on the rise. There's a new media deal being negotiated by the NBA with its media partners. So perhaps, you know, now's the time to go and maybe things level out. But for him, it was interesting because he said, well, it was the right time. And then he paused and said, maybe it's never the right time. So that was my biggest takeaway, was that, you know, he clearly made a business deal. This is what he does. This is why he has billions of dollars. You know, his company buys distressed assets and then sells them once they improved. And I guess you could argue that the Bucks were distressed asset in 2014. And look where they are now.
I think you absolutely can.
Yeah, that's so
perfect, Jim.
You know, 7 straight winning seasons, 8 playoff appearances. Yeah, there were some bumps along the way, especially in the early going. But it's really hard as a sports owner, especially in this state, to really quibble with what they've done, what he was a part of with Wesley and Jamie Dimon, and of course, a plethora of other owners. So, but I would say that was the biggest takeaway, JR, was, you know, a little bit of, wow, okay, it's over. Like kind of that hitting him a little bit. You know, he had sort of maintained throughout, like, well, it's not done until it's done. It's not done until it's done. Well, it's done now. And, you know, the players, I thought, Giannis, the big three, and Pat Connaughton, I thought those were important voices to hear from. And none of them were surprised. You know, Giannis and Chris in particular have small ownership stakes in other teams, in other leagues. And they totally got it. And Drew said, actually, he's like, look, someone who had played for a couple other teams, you know, Mark's management style was unique. The fact that he was available, not just for a phone call, but if they were in New York and wanted to have lunch, he was a guy they could bend their ear on, and you know, Chris and Pat call him a mentor, you know? So deeply personal relationships, which I think we all might have guessed, but it was interesting to hear from the guys themselves and say that had built up over the last, you know, 5 to 9 years. So those were the most interesting parts of that that story for me.
It's always delicate talking about an owner. You know, you don't want to praise an owner too much. That sounds wrong to say that out loud quite like that. But, you know, those who are able to buy franchises and sell franchises are people who've made their money in a lot of different ways. Some of them are unsavory. And so there's always a little bit of hesitation when you want to say whether or not an owner is good or not. Obviously, most people just look at the win-loss record and say whether or not an owner is good, which I think is also an unfair way of doing it. But you do get the sense that Mark Lazary was pretty good at this. You know, he was able to foster that relationship with the players that you're talking about. He did seem to care very deeply. We know he loved basketball. My example of him showing up in the celebrity All-Star games and at in the All-Star weekends. He loved this stuff. And that's good. It can be a bad thing, but I didn't get the sense it necessarily was. They empowered John Horst, which was a non-traditional hire at the time. They clearly saw something there, and that has worked out. You know, we talked about all of John Horst's moves, how they seem to have been success building upon success, and that was obviously a good maneuver. Mike Budenholzer was a smart hire. You know, there was the Jason Kidd stuff, which I guess you could point to as maybe a misfire, but I don't know. Like, even that's a little debatable, if that maybe set some things in motion that ultimately led the Bucks where they wanted to be, which is a team that unquestionably is going to make the playoffs at the start of the year. I mean, that's a great spot to be in. He even kind of alluded to that. It's really hard to get your franchise to a point where you know the Bucks are going to the playoffs at the start of the year. It's just a matter of, you know, are they the one seed or not, you know? And that's a pretty enviable spot. They obviously got their transcendent player to sign a Supermax deal, so that's great too. Laura, do you have any thoughts on the ownership situation yourself?
I just wanted to compliment both of you on your comments. And Jim, you did a really good job with that story. I hope everybody goes to JS Online and reads it, because I was really interested in the player reaction that you got. And I thought the most interesting element to me, being from Milwaukee, growing up here my whole life, going to Bucks games to cover them and seeing Senator Herb Cole, you know, on his own eating dinner before pregame, to me, what's different is this has really become a business, right? I thought the whole point of owning a team was the fun of owning your own team and getting to be like the ultimate super fan and having the best seats in the house. But apparently that's a different world now. We don't have local ownership. These folks aren't from Milwaukee or Wisconsin. We're talking numbers that I can't even picture or relate to at all. I'm still cutting coupons when I go shopping to Sendix. And I just thought, you know, to me, it just shows this, Jim's story showed this awesome transition between what was kind of considered a local thing, which we're known for in Milwaukee between the Brewers and the Bucks, to now being just an entirely business transaction. And I have very mixed feelings about it, but you did a really good job with that, Jim. Good job.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
So now we move to the awards stuff. We're finally going to get some resolution on the awards. They'll start to roll out here over the next couple weeks. And certainly the Bucks will be mentioned. We've got Bobby Portis as a finalist for the sixth man of the year. You certainly have Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's probably not going to win, but is in the mix with Nikola Jokic and Joel Embiid, the year-long conversation over MVP. And tonight, it's Defensive Player of the Year. Tonight, as we record this again on Monday, we're going to find out if Brook Lopez has won the award. He's a finalist along with Jaren Jackson Jr. of the Memphis Grizzlies, an extremely talented young player who was an all-star this year, and Evan Mobley of Cleveland, likewise, even younger, who's really had a breakthrough and has made Cleveland a pretty tough matchup, actually, which they actually lose their first game as well to the New York Knicks. So that was an interesting start to their playoff series as well. But one of the best defensive teams in basketball. And I really thought this was wrapped up. I still think Brook is going to win, but I'm not positive. It's a super interesting setup. You know, Jaren Jackson Jr. played only 28 minutes a game, so that would be the knock on him, even though I know he's got a huge reputation as an exciting shot blocker and defensive presence. Brook Lopez, coming off of this back surgery, I still can't believe that he was able to play in 78 games this year. He played more than 30 minutes a game and is really, really just, we've talked about it, but just a really special season from him. So, Jim, talk about the awards process a little bit. I don't know exactly what you have a vote in, but I'm sure you've given this some thought. So how do you think this plays out tonight?
Well, the two questions there. I vote for everything.
Oh, very good.
I vote for all the awards, all the teams. The PBWA rotates that, or the NBA, I guess, rotates it between myself.
Tell people what that is. What is that? Tell people what that is.
Oh, the Professional Basketball Writers Association, of which you need to be a member to vote in these things. And Milwaukee, with only two full-time beat writers, with the Journal Sentinel and the Athletic, the NBA rotates that vote, at least it has, since two have been around. I believe in the olden days when team employees could vote, meaning the broadcasters, Jim Paschke voted for a long time. Journal Sentinel writers voted for a long time as well. So I vote for everything. This is not like baseball or I think football, where they kind of parse those out to different groups. So we'll start with DPOY, since that is top of mind and the first thing that's announced. I did vote for Brook Lopez as a Defensive Player of the Year. Jaren Jackson was second, Evan Mobley third. Those are the three finalists. I think Brook earned that. While Jaren is very dynamic, you know, I don't need to state the case. I think Bucks fans know that. I think when you watch him on a nightly basis this year, it's hard to argue against him. I think he's one of the reasons their three-point defense was one of the best in the league, because he was a guy who also helped contest threes along with what he was doing inside the paint. And I think when Giannis, a former Defensive Player of the Year of his own, is so effusive and sort of says that, hey, like, this is the crux of this, Jrue Holiday, you know, for as good as he is, who maybe got some DPOY votes along the line. We'll see when the league announces all of that down the line. Brooke clearly to me was that guy from game one to, you know, 80 that he played.
Yeah, like I've said before, he'd be the oldest guy to win the award, which I think is a marvel. I mean, obviously defense, you know, it's a relentless game and you're hard pressed at you know, 6'11", 7 foot and 35 years old to continue to keep pace with some of the younger players in the league. Evan Mobley's 21, or I think he might be 22 now, but this is his age 21 season. And you know, Jaren Jackson's a tick older than that, so a couple years older than that. So these are young guys, very exciting. They're high flying. Brook Lopez, for you know, he doesn't you know, he's not going to wow you with his sprint speed. He's not a guy who flies up the court, but he is just so gifted. His footwork is so good, and he just knows where to be. Truly special, and just a great personality as well that we've talked about a lot. It'd be very fun to see him come away with the award Monday night. I don't know how you feel about the other two cases. I mean, I think Bobby Portis has a chance at sixth man of the year, but it is unclear to me if he will realistically get in there. Obviously, that's a guy. He played very well, by the way, in game one, and he's in there with Malcolm Brogdon, of course, the former Bucks player and Boston Celtics guard who may actually win the award and then also face off with the Bucks at some point in this playoffs. Emmanuel Quickley of the New York Knicks is the other finalist. So, Jim, or I guess, Laurie, I mean, you guys feel free to chime in on where you think Bobby Portis falls, and we could mention Giannis, but I think we've talked enough about MVP. If we think Bobby, who was the energy, the beating heart of the Bucks in Game One, if he's going to be able to bring home some hardware as well.
I mean, look, I voted Bobby third on my ballot. I had Brogdon first. Actually, I did not vote for Emmanuel Quickley. I picked Malik Monk with Sacramento. I'm sure Bobby will let me know about this when this is released. This is not his fault. This is not Bobby's fault, but Malcolm Brogdon and Malik Monk played every game off the bench. They did not start any games for their teams. We can argue that if you are a great sixth man, you are the one who starts when others are hurt and you produce and win. And the Bucks did that. So maybe I'm splitting hairs. In that way, Bobby had a tremendous season, a career year. He deserves to be a finalist. If he wins, you will not hear a word from me about that. I just thought Malcolm Brogdon, what he did for Boston off the bench in so many different areas on a nightly basis, frankly, was too hard to ignore for a team that challenged the Bucks for the one seed, was the one seed for much of the season. I think a lot of that had to do with Malcolm. And so that's how my ballot should go.
Are we going to have to get back into the weeds of what happens if they don't let Malcolm Brogdon go? I don't know. We could revisit that. That's a very popular one, Jim.
Maybe we could down the line. I don't know. I think Bucks fans will take Drew Holiday every day of the week.
Every day of the week, yes. They came out ahead. But a quality year for Brogdon. And like I said, the Bucks, that will certainly be a storyline to watch if the Bucks get into an Eastern Conference Finals with the Celtics. Malcolm Brogdon is a big piece of what they do. So we will see if that comes to pass.
You're not interested in how I voted for MVP?
Go ahead. Tell me. I know you voted for Giannis. So I guess it didn't occur to me to bring that my curiosity to the wider audience here. All right, go ahead. Tell us who did you vote for MVP?
John? Yeah, I think people want to know. I did vote for Giannis as MVP. Joel Embiid was second. Nikola Jokic was third for me. It is a top five vote, so I rounded that out with Jason Tatum and then Donovan Mitchell. I'll be honest though, it was like Giannis is the MVP to me. He only played 63 games. I struggled with that, to be honest. It's you have to be available, and that actually filtered down into my all NBA votes, which I'm curious if I get some hives on social media from some fan bases, because I left some really, really popular names off my All-NBA ballot because I felt like he didn't play enough. Jokic and Embiid played more games than him. It was just a handful more, so that was part of it. But I thought, again, I don't need to make the case. I think he had been my MVP vote in the last two straw polls with ESPN. Starts as simply best player, best team, but I think Giannis also did other things. But I think it's worth noting he would not be eligible for this award should he play 63 games going forward. The NBA and the Players Association agreed to a 65-game threshold. That's not the case this year, but I did struggle with that a little bit, JR and Laurie, I'll be honest. 63 games is tough. And even Jokic, and they might be the fewest games played by an MVP winner since Allen Iverson played in a non-shortened year, like 71. So it kind of shows you where some of this stuff has gone. And availability to me matters, but I think Giannis was so tremendous this year that he deserved my vote. And I'll say this, as the beat writer, I probably hold him to a higher standard than most, because whatever a bias that may be in there from seeing him every day. So I feel like I judged him more critically than others to do that.
I think when I think of Joel Embiid, I do think of injuries as part of his story, but that hasn't really been the case. He played 66 games this year, like you said, and more than 34 minutes a game. Last year, he played 68 games and was close to 34 minutes a game. I mean, he is out there. He is available. And we're splitting a little bit of hairs. Embiid versus Giannis is a difference of 3 games. But if you're looking, if you're looking to split hairs against some of the best, the 3 best players in the world, I can understand that. Embiid is going to win. If you look at some of the sort of straw polls out there right now, the sort of tracking of ballots and whatnot of the people who said who they're voting for, I think Embiid is going to win. But I think it'll be fine. I think it'll be deserved. I know that people were really down on John Hollinger's, like, it's his time or whatever, and we can debate the merits of that. But I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that he should win it. I don't hate the idea of choosing the best player on the best team if he is, definitely one of the 3 best players in the league like Giannis is. But best player on best team for me, if you go back through history, there are plenty of teams that were great that didn't have a player who deserved to be, like Richard Hamilton, great player, and the Pistons were great with him and they won a title, and like he's not the MVP of the league. There are going to be other people who are MVP of the league. So I don't necessarily put a lot of stock in that concept by itself. Obviously it's a little different when we are talking about one of the 3 best guys in the league, and Giannis was that, and he'll get votes, and he'll get attention, and he might in the end get a ring, and that will be the thing that everyone cares about at the end of the day. It's funny how history is going to look back on, oh yeah, he won back-to-back MVPs. Everyone's going to assume that one of those years was when they won the title in 2021. It's going to take people are going to really struggle with, like, wait, he won back-to-back MVPs and then won a title but didn't win MVP that year? That's weird. So history's going to mush those things together, I think, as we get further and further away from that championship. I think that's good, guys. I think we've hit everything. Game 2 is Wednesday night, 8:00 tip time. So I don't know, drink some extra caffeine.
Well, actually, JR, I do know this just from fans who have mentioned this. We don't need to go through my non-Bucks ballot, but fans are very interested in my all defensive, all NBA. So I'm going to at least say this. Giannis Antetokounmpo was on my first team all NBA ballot.
Okay.
And Drew Holiday was on my third team ballot. Brooke was tough on that one, but I felt Domantas Sabonis in Sacramento earned that third team all NBA center. I think his just overall season was just fantastic, spectacular. He was an all-star behind Jokic and Joel Embiid. Now, all defense, honestly, this gave me the biggest headache of all of the ballots. The league was restrictive with positions. Some were given some flexibility, others were not. So this may surprise some folks. I voted Brook Lopez Defensive Player of the Year. He was my first team all defensive center. I did vote Drew Holiday as a first-team all-defensive guard. My first-team forwards, Jaden McDaniels of Minnesota and Jaren Jackson Jr. of Memphis. Jaren Jackson is a forward. He is not a center. And those guys are forwards. Obviously, you heard I voted Evan Mobley as he is a Defensive Player of the Year finalist. He's also a forward. He is on my second team. We could quibble that. Like, how do you vote a Defensive Player of the Year vote, but then not have on your first team? That's a weird thing for me. Maybe Cavs fans can hit at me. But so that leaves one forward spot. And no, that did not go to Giannis Antetokounmpo. I voted OG Anunoby in Toronto. For as good as Giannis is defensively, I don't think that was a fantastic part of his game this year. He is an incredible defender. It did play a role in my MVP vote in terms of like over the other guys. But I just had to acknowledge Cleveland's tremendous defense. I could not ignore Jaren Jackson Jr. or Jaden McDaniels, what he did for the Timberwolves defensively as an individual. Same thing with Ananobi. I think, you know, in the vacuum, they were special. So Giannis will probably be all defense, I would guess, but he did not make that for me. So I think Bucks fans will be interested in that. But of course, this will all be released by the league whenever they do such a thing, I think after the MVP vote.
Yes, I will send them with their pitchforks after you. I will absolutely link to this podcast so they can hear the conversation, because need those clicks if you're going to get angry with Jim Ozarski. Lori, we haven't heard from you for a minute, but before I send you guys back into the ether, do you have any last thoughts?
I would like to let everyone know that it's really important to listen to Jim, because you shouldn't be a homer. Just because we cover the Milwaukee Bucks, it doesn't mean that we're rooting for them. We are unbiased and impartial. We don't wear their jerseys away from, you know, you have to do your job. You have to be a journalist. If we were covering politics, you wouldn't want us favoring one side or the other. And it's the same. We're seeing this way too much in the sports world right now, where there is so much partiality and bias and favoritism. So the whole reason to subscribe to the paper or to read Jim's stuff is because he's a professional, and he's really going to look at everybody in the league and be a tough critic and not be somebody who's rooting for anybody. That's really important. The ethics of journalism has changed so much. We need to cling to our standards and the things that matter. So I appreciate you, Jim. I appreciate that a lot.
It is a lot of mutual admiration over here on the Point Forward podcast.
Yeah. It's a tough thing. Look, man, there have been plenty of writers who have given up their ballots over the years for a variety of reasons. It's a tough thing, but something I know I take here very seriously. I did voting for NFL stuff. I know our colleagues on the Packers beat and the Brewers beat do the same. So, yeah, it's tough, but, you know, it comes with it. It's transparent, so I'm ready.
Yeah. But you want to be fair, but I want everybody, right. I'm not a groupie with a press pass. I'm here to do a job. I'm not, you know, and same with you. You got to be fair. You got to do as best as you can to fight against biases and things like that. Of course, we all have them, but that's really, we're seeing less and less of that in sports journalism. So I'm glad you still care about the old school ethical rules. So.
She is Lori Nickel. He is Jim Ozarski. They will be there back at Pfizer Forum on Wednesday when the Bucks and Miami Heat play game two of their first round playoff series. Thanks for joining me, friends. I will talk to you again next week, or who knows, maybe sooner if we get some crazy developments. We'll talk to you again, guys. We'll talk to you again soon, guys. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave a rating and review if you'd like, or just hit us up on Twitter. You can find any one of us, Lori Nickel, Jim Ozarski, myself, J.R. Radcliffe. We're all on there. And let us know what you think. We will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Point Forward podcast, a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and JSOnline.com production.